Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 81. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's wonderful to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast and welcome patrons who joined the Talking Tudors family in June. A very warm welcome to Ali, Chrissy, Ruth, Rhonda, Lisa, Lisa Kay, Rosie, Laura, Anna and Carrie, and a number of others joined but did not provide a first name, so my apologies for not mentioning you by name. I'm so very thankful for your support and immense generosity. If you love the Talking Tudors podcast and never miss an episode, perhaps you'd consider becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family, and in addition to receiving lots of Tudor-themed goodies, you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. July's prize is an Anne Boleyn cushion from Hever Castle. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about some wonderful Tudor artifacts is Rebecca Quinton. Rebecca is Research Manager Art for Glasgow Museums, where her remit covers European dress and textiles, including those in the Burrell Collection. She's also Honorary Senior Research Fellow at the University of Glasgow and was the inaugural convener of the MLIT in Dress and Textile Histories. Since 2016, she has been the chair of the UK Subject Specialist Network, Dress and Textile Specialists. Her publications include Patterns of Childhood Samplers from Glasgow Museum and 17th Century Costume in Glasgow Museums. Current research is focused on early modern embroideries in the Burrell Collection and legacies of slavery in Glasgow Museum's collections. My conversation with Rebecca straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors. Rebecca, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's wonderful that you could join us on the show today. I'm really excited to chat about some wonderful artifacts. But before we do that, could you please just introduce yourself to our listeners and just tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes, well, I'm the curator for the European Costume and Textiles Collection for Glasgow Museums here in Scotland. And my remit covers approximately 2,000 items, ranging from about 1250 to the present day. So I am very kind of wide dress historian, as opposed to having a very specialised period. That collection includes the most fantastic, wonderful medieval and modern textiles in the Borough collection. My interest started at an early age. Both my parents were art historians, so I spent my childhood being taken around art galleries, parish churches, country houses, and I started collecting postcards of full poster beds and the costume that was on display. And if we were taken to London and I had been a good girl, I was then allowed to go and see the costumes at the Victoria and Albert Museum. And it went from there. English degree, volunteering, museum studies followed, and then my first job at Brighton before becoming a fully fledged curator at Glasgow.
How wonderful. Now, I recently read an article, it was a blog post, I think, on the museum's website, and I read that one of your favourite objects is a pair of valances that once belonged to, well, we think Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. Could you describe these for our listeners who perhaps have never heard of them or seen them before, and maybe just tell us a little bit about what they look like?
Yes, so this is a pair of valances or bed valances. So they are very long, narrow, rectangular cloth panels that hang around the sides or the bottom of the tester of a four-poster bed. And they were to hide the rail and to reduce drafts between the bed and curtains. These ones are in a very beautiful light cream satin that's now beginning to get a little bit yellow and quite fragile with age. And then they've had an applied decoration that goes on 6 repeats on one and 7 on the other valance that's in a black silk velvet that's been appliqued on in an arabesque design that includes an H and an A cipher for Henry VIII and his second wife, Anne Boleyn. And then acorns and honeysuckles that are kind of entwined around them underneath. And along at the bottom, there's a really lovely checkerboard header fringe that's in red, black and cream. And around the edge of the black, everything has been kind of highlighted with an attached, couched on red thread, which is now looking more of a pink, but at the time would have been a really nice contrasting colours. At the back, it's just supported with a double linen canvas backing that gives it a strength and still enables us to be able to move the piece today because the silk is so fragile, it's beginning to shatter.
Oh, they're just beautiful. I know I've looked at lots of pictures online and they are truly exquisite. Now, I wanted to ask you about the honeysuckle and acorns that you mentioned. Is at some point during Anne and Henry's relationship, they adopted this as a sort of private motif. What do these symbolise and what would they have meant to people in Tudor times?
Yes, so the honeysuckle, which is also known as woodbine, has been traditionally associated with love, affection and devotion. If you're a gardener, you'll know it's a creeping plant and it's unable to support itself and therefore uses another plant or tree as a support and entwines its tendrils around it. It's a tradition in terms of the love going back from at least the early medieval period. There's a wonderful poem by Marie de France written in the 11th to 12th century about Tristan and his old, and she describes the lovers as like honeysuckle and hazel, both so entwined that without one, the other will die. And you'll get this poetic motif going right the way through the Tudor period into William Shakespeare. So Titania in Midsummer Night's Dream says to Bottom, "Sleep thou, and I will wind thee in my arms. So doth the woodbine, the sweet honeysuckle, gently entwist." So they've got that lovely idea of maybe Anne Boleyn wrapping herself around the sturdy Henry VIII. And the acorns are traditionally associated with fertility, growing as they do into mighty oak trees. The following century, they would also become a symbol of British royalty itself after Charles II managed to escape from parliamentary soldiers after the Battle of Worcester in 1651 by hiding in the branches of an oak tree at Boscobel House. But for Henry, they were probably there very much as a symbol of fertility and represented his hope for a longed-for heir.
These valances are not actually listed in the inventory of Henry VIII's movable goods that was compiled after his death in 1547, and which I love dipping into. So that sort of suggests that they were disposed of before that point. And now they eventually came to be in the possession of the Woodhouse or Wodehouse, hopefully one of those two pronunciations, family of Kimberley. So are there any links between Anne and this particular Norfolk family?
Yes, they are. However, when I first started working at the Borough Collection, the accepted story that the curator and all the volunteer guides said was that the valances were used on the occasion of a visit of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn to Kimberley in 1534. which I'd always found rather puzzling, as the Boleyn family may have come from Norfolk and Anne was born in Blickling. From growing up in Bristol, I know that Summer Progress in 1535 was to the West Country. So I double-checked the Summer Progresses, and there was only the one that in that year during Anne's time as Queen. And whilst the visit to Bristol itself was curtailed for the flare of the plague in the city at the time, they did stop off at Thornbury Castle, just in South Gloucestershire, and of course went back very famously now to London Vale Wolf Hall. But I could find no recorded visit of the royal couple to Norfolk, let alone Kimberley. So that ruled out an actual visit being the connection. So I then started looking back, and I started with the history of how Burrell got the phalanxes. And he bought them after they had been on display in the Art Treasures exhibition in Christie's in 1932. And in the review that I found in Country Life, M. Jordan talked about them being a connection between the marriage of Sir Thomas Woodhouse, the second baronet, with Blanche Carey, daughter of the third Lord Hunsdon. Well, Blanche Carey is obviously quite a well-known name for those studying this period of Tudor history. Blanche was the great-granddaughter of Anne's sister Mary Boleyn and her first husband William Carey, who'd been gentleman of the Privy Chamber and esquire to the body of the king. And she married, Blanche married her second husband on the 16th of June 1605, who was Sir Thomas Woodhouse of Kimberley. Now, whilst Blanche is a direct descendant of Mary, it does seem a little bit odd for the Valances to follow the male line for a couple of generations and then suddenly jump down to a younger daughter, rather than stay with her older brother, Henry, who became the first Earl of Dover. And I'm always a little bit uncertain about things that have passed down through the family without staying in the main line, because that's normally been where they've been put in the attic and inherited with the estate. So I just wanted to check if there had been another link. So I tracked down a copy of the Art Treasures catalogue itself. And in that, they stated that there was an alliance between the Woodhouses of Kimberley through the families of Boleyn and Shelton. Well, obviously, Shelton, again, is another big name for Anne Boleyn's court. So I went back through the Woodhouse family tree, and I found in an essay towards a topographical history of the county of Norfolk, published in 1739, that the author Bloomfield referred to a Thomas Woodhouse, who was never knighted. He in fact died after being standard bearer in the Battle of Musselburgh in 1547. And his widow was Margaret, daughter of Sir John Shelton, Shelton Knight. And of course, we all know, if you've been reading biographies of Anne Boleyn, who the Sheltons are. So Sir John Shelton's wife was the first Anne Boleyn, the aunt and possibly the namesake of our Queen Anne Boleyn. She was in charge of Princess Mary's house at Hatfield, and her daughters, Margaret and Mary, served in the Queen's court. They were both said to be court beauties, with one, possibly Margaret, getting in trouble with catching the eye of Sir Francis Weston and Sir Henry Norris, and one sister possibly becoming the mistress of Henry VIII. But at the moment, the historians seem to difference between whether this mistress or Marg Shelton was actually Margaret or Mary. So we'll have to leave that tidbit aside. And if only those Valances could talk.
Yes. Absolutely. There is quite good confusion with the Mary and the Margaret, definitely. Wow, what an incredible piece of detective work, Rebecca, that you did there. That just sounds like a lot of fun, actually.
Yes, it's something I'm getting quite good at, is doing genealogy, either whether it's for 19th century wedding dresses or 16th century textiles.
So while the Valances aren't recorded in the 1547 inventory, there are actually several other items featuring the honeysuckle and the acorns pairing. Could you tell us about maybe one or two of these?
Yes, there's several that appear, and as Eric Ives noted in his wonderful biography of Anne Boleyn, there are items of clothing. There's a beautiful sounding pair of sleeves of white satin embroidered over with pearled gold acorns and honeysuckles, tied with 10 pairs of aigulettes of gold. So the pearled is a twisted metal coil that was used in embroidery, and then they would have been tied on. That's the aigulettes of gold. There's also furnishings, cushions, and this most fantastic carpet of gold, silk and silver needlework with roses of red and white, and Queen Anne's ciphers with a border about the same of honeysuckles, acorns, H and A of like needlework, fringed at both ends with a deep fringe, and at both sides with a narrow fringe of Venice gold, silk and silver, lined with a green damask. That sounds wonderful. And that one seems to still be in the royal collection 100 years later, when they do the inventories and valuations of the king's good after the beheading of Charles I. And again, there are still cushions there in that inventory, ones that have got, again, Venice gold, Venice silver, honeysuckles, acorns, three roses in white and red with Queen Anne's cipher. So her whole suite must have been full of this cipher everywhere. It must have been quite fantastic.
Now, there is another intriguing item listed in the Burrell collection, and that's a ceremonial bedhead. And the details say that it was made for the marriage of Henry VIII to his fourth wife, Anne of Cleves. Could you tell us about this particular object?
Yes, this is a wonderful piece of surviving Tudor furniture. It's made out of oak, still quite pale. You tend to think of oak as being quite dark nowadays. And this one has been carved, painted with black and red, and then gilding over the top as well. And the decoration is in quite a Holbein-esque style. The three panels at the top have got lovely inscriptions. The first on the left, as you read it, has the royal motto, God and my right. And then the one in the centre describes King Henry, by the grace of God, King of England and France, Lord of Ireland and head of the Church of England, 1539. And then on the right, again, we get the monogram of the Queen-to-be and Henry and A.H. At either end of them, you've got these two little wonderfully animated figures that are carved in, a man on the left and a woman on the right, symbolising fertility. Research done by my colleagues Laura Bald and Rachel King has confirmed that this is indeed definitely a ceremonial bedhead and not part of some other architectural feature, as has sometimes been thought. However, we've not been able to discover whether it's the bed used on their fateful wedding night or one of the ones that was commissioned for Anne's use during her progress after she arrived on the Kent coast near Deal and made her way up to London for the wedding.
How wonderful. Now, I wanted to ask you something about the oak, because you mentioned that it was quite a sort of pale oak, because I have seen people question and ask before, does the oak actually darken throughout the centuries? I've also read that possibly varnishes have been applied, and that's why certain pieces appear so dark and some of that panelling. Can you maybe enlighten us on this a little?
Yes. So oak, when it was originally used, tends to be a much paler oak. I think it's one of those things now, if you go and buy yourself an oak kitchen, it's more likely to be a mid-colour oak, not the dark oak that we tend to see. And last year, I was fortunate to go to Jamestown in Virginia, where they were remaking for their reproduction village there, the furniture of the early 17th century in the oak. And seeing it pale and the colours of the textiles was quite amazing, very different from how we see it now. However, with time, the woods darken. Most woods will darken with time, with oxidization, with the chemical and pollutants in the air. And then you also have this attitude nowadays that we expect our oak to be dark if it's antique furniture. So certainly in the trade, and certainly in the 19th century, when they were trying to put old pieces back together again and were maybe adding in new wood to kind of make a complete bed, make a complete cabinet, they were then actually also applying a varnish to make them look dark, make them look as old and 500 years old.
Yeah, so the Tudor interiors wouldn't have been then as dark and oppressive as you kind of imagine when you look at those pieces that have obviously been, you know, varnished and then are much darker.
Yes, I think people tend to think of them as being kind of dark and then with faded textiles. But if you make the wood lighter, put the gilding back so it's reflecting the light, and then put the colours, and having had the advantage of seeing the backs of tapestries, the backs of embroideries, and this, remembering these are still natural dyes, but they are the best quality natural dyes. They are as bright as any modern dyes can be. And I think people would probably be quite shocked by how garish it might have been.
Yes, yes. I saw one when I was at Hampton Court once in the Great Hall. They had a special sort of lighting arrangement on one of the tapestries that reflected what it sort of would have looked like when it was first made. And it was quite a shock to see just how vibrant those things were.
Yes, when you get some of those bright colours, the ochre, the madder then being replaced by cochineal to give you a really bright one. And one of the things we've got very interested in, and there was a big project on the Burrell tapestries, it was looking to see how they faded. And some of the bright colours we know faded quite quickly, like ochre, they had given a very strong purple. And they knew that. So that must have been part of you showing that this was a new set. And if you were royalty, replacing them quickly, knowing that that old one has faded, so I'm going to buy a new one. I've got the money to buy a new one. Yeah, so that added another eye kind of layer to it in terms of the ones that we know they're investing and a colour will last, to those other ones where maybe a sign of their conspicuous consumption is being able to replace ones that have got colours that will fade.
So I was recently browsing the Glasgow Museum's online navigator and came across several other items associated with Kimberley Hall that you mentioned earlier, including a velvet canopy and a cushion. And the details said that it was made for a visit of Elizabeth I to Kimberley Hall on the 22nd of August 1578. So thrones with a canopy and cloth of estate are prominent in Tudor portraiture. How were they used and what do they represent?
Well, the cloth of state, or sometimes cloth of estate, was a ceremonial set of hangings that was placed behind and over a monarch's throne to signify their status, their wealth, and their power. They generally consisted of the canopy and a tester, which was the long panel that hung either over the top of the canopy on the inside and then fell down the back. And that was normally decorated with the royal coat of arms. The majority of the English ones are in a crimson red silk velvet. With other royal families, it might be that they use blue, such as the French monarchy, and they could either be left a plain velvet, or there's a wonderful one that you can see in the portrait of Henry VIII and his family that's now at Hampton Court, which you can see they've also covered the whole ground with a silver gilt embroidery of entwined plants and flowers. They were there to, I suppose, to elevate the monarch, and the only other place that you get to see these cloth of estate is often over the altar in cathedrals. The other time where you might possibly see a cloth of estate by itself was at the back of law courts, and it was there to signify the power and authority of the monarch in absentia. So if the king couldn't sit in every law case across the land, if you had something with his royal coat of arms hanging as a tapestry or as an embroidered hanging in the courtroom, it was there to represent the authority of the throne coming down to the sheriff or the magistrate at the time. The Kimberley throne set, though, is very interesting. It's a bit of an amalgamation, probably put together for this visit that we know is well documented. Elizabeth was visiting her cousins, and she had previously knighted Sir Roger Woodhouse earlier on her progress in Norfolk, and then went and decided to go and stay with him on her way back through the county. The canopy and the valances hanging around at the bottom are a beautiful Italianate applied arabesque design that's been done in cloth of tissue applied to the red silk velvet, and were probably made for her progress around Norfolk, and I suspect was originally paired with a tester of Elizabeth's own that was embroidered with her coat of arms that went with her from place to place. She's not going to leave her own tester with that authority behind her. The family has then kept this as an heirloom, and they actually had it out for people to come and visit. And I think they've then slipped in a tester that was made slightly earlier for Roger Woodhouse when he married Mary Corbett in about 1554, because the wonderful engraved coat of arms that we have on our tester is that of Woodhouse, with his wildman supporters on either side, a wonderful pun on the name, and then the one on the ceiling is impaled with his wife's coat of arms for Corbett.
Okay, so a slight mixture of pieces in that one.
Yes, I've always been puzzled by the two dates, so again, that's the one that I've been looking at the family history, and it just makes sense for them to have kind of put the two together. And it's recorded in guides to the county from the early 18th century as something to go and see if you're in Kimberley. Go and look at that royal throne.
And are any of these items that we've been chatting about on public display for when we can get back out and about?
Not just yet, not at the moment. They are all in the Burrell collection, which is closed temporarily for a major refurbishment supported by the National Heritage Lottery Fund here in the United Kingdom. We are not only upgrading the building, but also extending the gallery space, which will allow us to put more objects out on display. When we do reopen, we will have both the ceremonial bedhead out, which we've always had out on display, but we're also going to be including the valances one at a time so that they can be displayed in rotation. However, as with so many things at the moment, the project has been affected by the current pandemic. So we're not entirely sure when we're open. We're working with our contractors to make sure that everything is carried out in line with public health advice. So we haven't quite got a date. So please do check our website and social media We've also got lots of nice videos going up showing the scenes behind. When we get going again, we'll be showing time-lapse photography of the project.
Oh, fantastic. I'm so excited that there is thoughts of putting it on public display. That's wonderful. Now, I wanted to ask you, Rebecca, I know that they're one of your favourite items. What are your other really loved items in the collection? So many to choose from.
I know, so many. So probably in the Burrell collection, one of the ones that people really do like is we've got one of those wonderful early 17th century embroidered waistcoats. So that's the linen that's been completely covered in a curling stems ranso design, worked in silver gilt thread, and beautiful coloured embroidery. And its pair it is in Bath. There's two waistcoats that have got the same design. So that's always a crowd pleaser. In the main costume collection, which we store at Glasgow Museum's Resource Centre and display in the other museums across the city, the current favourite, particularly when it goes out on social media, is a beautiful blue going away outfit that was made in 1899 for Elizabeth Kerr Holmes Kerr, who married John Deans Hope. She grew up in a very affluent part of the city, and she managed to go down to London and get a court dressmaker to make her this beautiful blue outfit. And everybody always seems to like it, to the extent that we had one Lord Provost who remembered it from being on display in the 1980s and asked for a copy to be made for her to wear in a procession celebrating the anniversary of the opening of Kelvin Grove.
Wow, I think I have seen a picture of that one too, and it's quite stunning. Well, Rebecca, you're very lucky to work with such incredible treasures. Now, at the end of our Talking Tudors episodes, what we like to do is play what I call a little game of 10 to go. So these are just 10 questions to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready to do that?
Yes, let's go.
Excellent. What's an inspirational place close to home that you enjoy visiting?
For me, it's probably Pollock Park, which is where the Burrell Collection is situated. It's a lovely country park that has an 18th century house, Pollock House, in it. But the best thing is it's got Highland cattle. And at this time of year, they've all got little calves and they are the cutest things.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Now, you did mention in your introduction that even when you were a child, you were interested in sort of costume and history. But was there ever a point where you wanted to do something completely different?
Oh, yes. I went to a very traditional grammar school. And whilst I spent my childhood going around museums, it wasn't until I was at university that I clicked about I could actually have a job in one. And I had initially been looking at a completely different career as becoming an engineer.
Oh, OK. So, yeah, very different. Wonderful. And what was the last book that you read? Or maybe are still reading?
At the moment, I tend to read a lot of biographies of women. So I thought I should probably do a bit of a gender balance. So I'm currently just finishing Tracy Bullman's biography of the men at Henry VIII's court.
Excellent. Yes, I have that one here on my desk. Haven't started yet, but I will get to it, definitely. So what is a movie that you've watched more than once?
Ah, that one for me is probably going to be The Draftsman's Contract, which is a beautiful Peter Greenaway film, quite an early one for him. It's set at the time of William and Mary, a very stylized story, but the most fantastic costumes in a palette of black and white. Not the happiest of films, but done very, very stylishly.
Well, I have to add that to the list because I have not seen that. What about a favorite childhood toy?
Again, this is where I'm going to be away from the normal thing of a girl. It was my Hornby railway set.
Oh, lovely. My daughter loved her Thomas engines when she was little. That's all good. Do you have a pet?
I do. She's been locked out of the room so she doesn't come and pester us. But yes, we have a lovely little cat.
And what do you do to relax and recharge the batteries?
Well, I do a little bit of yoga for the soul, and then I occasionally do embroidery, but I always get a little bit frustrated doing it at the end of the day. My eyes are tired and it's never as good as the stuff I work on. So tend to do, and I tried knitting, but I can't knit and drink. So I've settled on quilting.
I just
make small quilts, either to kind of protect furniture from the cat hair or to give to friends for children.
Wonderful. I'd like to learn embroidery. I think that would be so fantastic. That'd make me feel like a Tudor woman for sure, definitely. What about a signature recipe? Do you have one?
Not especially. I'm not a brilliant cook, so I tend to have to follow other people's recipes. And I do tend to like Nigella Lawson's stuff. She tends to put in the full butter and that gets my approval.
Yes, doesn't take the calorie shortcuts, that's for sure. Yeah. And what, talking about food, what's a favourite comfort food for you?
For me, I don't drink tea or coffee, so I really am a chocoholic. And there's nothing that can't be a chocolate cake or some beautiful truffles.
And if you could spend 5 minutes with anybody from the past, any century, any period, who would you choose?
That is so tricky, so tricky. And it varies depending on what I've been working on. I think at the moment it would probably be the lady in the Sanchez Coelho portrait of a lady in a fur wrap actually find out who she was.
Who she was, yeah, that sounds good. And lucky last, what piece of advice do you wish you could give your younger self?
Oh, to be more confident and to, yes, if you've got a gut instinct, it's probably going to be right and just go for it.
Yeah, that's really good advice, I think, for anyone listening as well. And the very, very, very last thing we do is I always ask my guests for a Tudor takeaway. So this is just a little gem for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode. It could be a website, a song to listen to, or a movie to watch. Do you have a Tudor takeaway?
I do. You very kindly have already been promoting it. It is our Navigator, which is our online collection database. We are in the process of publishing everything in the Burrell collection, which includes not only the items we've chatted about today that are directly associated with Tudors, but lots of examples of the material culture of the time, stained glass, furniture, treen, tigerwares. So if you're reading or seeing anything and going, oh, what does that look like? What was that? Do go and have a look. One particular favourite is a beautiful set of 12 sycamore trenchers that were made for a banquet, and they've got little poems on each side. So you could eat on one side and then switch it over and read this poem, and that would trigger some conversation.
Yes, I saw those. I was looking at those and I thought they were absolutely beautiful. I'd love to have like a copy of them. That would be really lovely. That would be great at dinner parties, I think. And yes, I will put a link to the wonderful online Navigator in our show notes so that everyone can find that really easily. So, Rebecca, thank you so much. It's been so great talking to you, and I'm really thankful that you chose to talk Tudors with me.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been wonderful.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.